This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Good morning. This is Janice. I'm reading the State Journal Register for the morning of May 2nd, 2024. And we are looking at the front page. The top story is Adult Learners Program Ending. District 186 Services Help with Diplomas. A Springfield District 186 program that caters to adults seeking a high school diploma and other workforce services is shutting its doors after the school year. Staff members at Lawrence Education Center were informed about the decision from building administration last week, according to Lawrence Education Center's workplace coordinator, Alex Rockford. Rockford went public with the announcement during a public comment section at Tuesday's Committee of the Whole meeting. The Committee of the Whole, or COW, is the working group of the Springfield City Council. "I'm devastated for our students," Rockford told the State Journal Register afterwards. "I'm devastated for the opportunities our school provided. I'm devastated for our staff that no longer has employment in this capacity." Lincoln Land Community College has an adult education program that has some overlap, Rockford said, but isn't synonymous with Lawrence. Rockford said she has often sent students to LLCC's program and has a good working relationship with it. Rachel Dias, D-Y-A-S, a spokeswoman for District 186, said in a statement that it had collaborated with LLCC and the district will still serve as a liaison to support students in gaining access to LLCC programming. The district also will use its communications platforms to support LLCC. In the past, Dias said that the adult education grant available from the Illinois Community College Board was held separately by the district and LLCC to the detriment of both programs. After attending conferences for adult education programming, the shift has moved from school districts having adult education programming to community colleges serving in this role, as they have more resources and career programming readily available upon completion, Dias said. The goal, she added, is for the district to work with LLCC and utilize its GED/equivalency program for district identified as qualifying candidates. Dontell Young of Springfield went through Lawrence Education Center and is set to graduate later this month. Young said some people might not feel comfortable going to LLCC. "Lawrence Adult was like a second home. It was a family. They helped get me through everything," said Young, who is getting his certified nursing assistant license through Loaves and Fishes Outreach in Springfield. Several Lawrence Education Center students, including Young, and staff members attended Tuesday's meeting. Ward 2 Alderman Sean Gregory said the closing was a gut punch to our community. Lawrence Education Center and the Springfield Learning Academy moved to White Oaks Mall last summer, becoming the first Simon Youth School program in Illinois. Simon Property Group operates the mall. "It's sad to see Lawrence shut its doors because I've seen what an impact it has and what it means to our students," Rockford said. "We're trying to get the last of our students through and find options for those who may not graduate and be able to provide the support that's needed. It is a family at Lawrence. We pour into these students every day. We build those relationships because sometimes we know they just need that one person who believes in them, and that's what's going to get them that secondary completion and building a better life." Springfield Education Association President Aaron Graves confirmed that while Lawrence Education Center teachers are supported, they are not represented by the union. Last summer, Graves expressed concern about the relationship between the district and Simon Properties, questioning if it was about filling real estate vacancy. The Board of Education last June approved a 7-year lease with Simon Properties. This school year, the district is paying $144,000 to lease the space, which formerly housed ITT Technical Institute. Both programs had previously been located at 101 East Lawrence Street. When it comes to corporate partnerships, please consider always that we're making the right decisions that are truly best for our students and our staff, Graves told the board at the time. Lawrence Education Center's final graduation is set for May 31st. And our next front page story. Four local schools rated top in state. Williamsville, Porta High Schools, among ranked. Four Springfield area schools made its way to the top 200 public high schools in Illinois, according to a new report from U.S. News and World Report. Nearly 18,000 public high schools nationwide were ranked based on their performance on state assessments, graduation rates, and how well they prepare students for college. Here's a look at the top five schools in the Springfield area. Chatham-Glenwood High School. Chatham-Glenwood High School boasts the highest rating of schools in the area, with an 82.2 out of 100 score. Ranked 110th in Illinois, the school has a graduation rate of 93% and saw 30% of its students take at least one advanced placement exam. Rochester High School. Coming in second with a 76.5 out of 100 score was Rochester High School. The 152nd ranked school in the state, 95% of its students graduated and 39% participated in an advanced placement test. Williamsville High School is the third highest rated school in the area, with a 96% graduation rate and 27% taking at least one advanced placement test, the school was ranked 184th in Illinois. Porta High School just snuck into the top 200, coming in as the 196th school in Illinois. Porta has a graduation rate of 78%, and 24% of its students took at least one advanced placement test. Pleasant Plains High School, the fifth best school in the area and 218th overall in the state. The school has a graduation rate of 92% and 33% of its student population took at least one advanced placement test. The best of the rest. Here's a look at how the remaining schools in the Springfield area fared across the state according to the report. Springfield High School, 232nd. Athens Senior High School, 246th. Auburn High School, 401. New Berlin High School, 413th. Riverton High School, 419th. Lanphier High School, 477th to 673rd. Pawnee Junior and Senior High School, 477th to 673rd. Springfield Southeast High School, 477th to 673rd. And Tri-City High School, 477th to 673rd. And our final front page story, funeral for Springfield teen set for next week. Springfield police are continuing to talk to several juveniles in connection with the shooting death of 16-year-old Kayon Day just across from Dreamland Park on Taylor Avenue last week. Deputy Chief Sarah Pickford said shots which struck Day in the lower torso were fired from a vehicle. Two vehicles in question, occupied by seven juveniles, all from Springfield, were later recovered by Springfield Police Department, she confirmed. Day, a sophomore at Southeast High School, was walking to school from his grandmother's house on the day when he was shot around 8:40 a.m. Day was rushed to surgery at HSHS St. John's Hospital, where he was pronounced dead. Day was a popular student. Day was a popular student at Southeast and a state qualifier in the 4x400 relays as a freshman. He also played junior varsity football. Sorry, my computer jumped. Moments of silence were held for Day at the City Boys and Girls Track and Field Meet at Ray Ramsey Track and Field at Memorial Stadium, and at the Springfield City Council's Committee of the Whole meeting. Union Baptist lead pastor, the Reverend T. Ray McJunkins, reached out earlier this week, said he knew several members of Day's family, though he didn't know the teen personally. McJunkins will preside over the funeral service. "We don't get over something like this," McJunkins said. "We get through this. We won't forget Kayon. We don't want to forget Kayon." Several Southeast students are members of Union Baptist, McJunkins said, and he called them to the altar at Sunday service to pray for them. "I'm sorry for the young man who lost his life, because all lives are worthy," said Mayor Misty Buescher in an interview with the State Journal Register Tuesday. "I think in our nation right now, we see a lot of discourse and people not respecting human life, and that is sad to me." Buescher reiterated that public safety is a number one concern for her administration. "I am concerned about our youth and our community and juveniles in general, because I think we really need to focus on how to keep our youth engaged in nonviolent ways," she added. Day's funeral service is at Union Baptist Church in Springfield at 11 a.m. on May 7th. Turning the page. Community mourns police officers' deaths. Local officials and community members came together Tuesday night to honor four law enforcement officers slain in an hours-long standoff. Charlotte, North Carolina, Mayor Bi Lyles addressed a room of about 50 people from the pulpit of Little Rock AME Zion Church. "I make no apologies for my tears," she said. "What makes me whole is to be a genuine leader in this community who's not afraid to show vulnerability when it's necessary and needed." Authorities were trying to serve warrants Monday against Terry Clark Hughes Jr., 39, when Hughes opened fire, the Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Department said. Gunfire killed Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Officer Joshua Iyer and U.S. Marshals Task Force Officers Sam Pelosi, Alden Elliott, and Thomas Meeks Jr. All four were fathers. Four other Charlotte Mecklenburg officers were injured as well. Three have been released from the hospital, and one remains hospitalized in stable condition, the police department said. Hughes was fatally shot on the lawn. Lyles thanked the law enforcement officers who stood outside the hospital in the aftermath, the medical professionals who helped the injured, and the clergy who guided the families through the kinds of turmoil and disbelief that all was taking place at the same time. The mayor said the most difficult part of the experience was when Iyer died from his injuries. He was married and had a 3-year-old son. "Our challenge to this community is to make sure that that 3-year-old son grows up knowing his dad," Lyles said. "His dad was a law enforcement officer. He was a hero. He was someone that we should be proud to know and speak of. Flowers in memory of the slain men have been placed outside the federal courthouse and Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Headquarters. Photos from the scene show. 4 officers, fathers, brothers, and sons demonstrated the best of human courage and conviction and selflessness so great that they were willing to give their lives to protect their community and their families, U.S. Representative Alma S. Adams said from the pulpit. However, she said, "The time is up for simply commemorating victims. Assault weapons, what she calls weapons of war, like the high-powered rifle used by the suspect, do not belong on our streets," the Congresswoman said. "We need to turn our anguish into action." Investigations are ongoing, including one by the Charlotte Mecklenburg's Internal Affairs Unit. Officials have declined to discuss the specifics of the incident, including whether it was appropriate for law enforcement to engage in a lengthy gun battle in the middle of a neighborhood in the middle of the day. At least 12 Charlotte Mecklenburg police officers fired their weapons during the incident. All are on paid administrative leave, the department said in a statement Tuesday. Hundreds arrested at New York campus protests. At Columbia, officers take control of the building. Police respond at UCLA. Police announced almost 300 arrests at 2 universities in the city, while at the University of California, Los Angeles, officers in riot gear swept onto campus early Wednesday as opposition to Israel's war in Gaza continued to roll through campuses across the nation. Dozens of the New York arrests involved pro-Palestinian demonstrators removed late Tuesday from an administration building at Columbia University, where officers also removed encampments that had been the epicenter of the protest nationwide. Students and outside activists breaking Hamilton Hall doors, mistreating our public safety officers and maintenance staff, and damaging property are acts of destruction, not political speech, Columbia President Manoush Shafiq said in a statement Wednesday. She said many students felt unwelcome because of the disruption and anti-Semitic comments from some protesters. At City College, affiliated with CUNY, officials requested NYPD assistance after the college said students and unaffiliated external individuals refused to leave. Protesters and police clashed at the University of Wisconsin-Madison when officers broke up an encampment there Wednesday. Video from the scene showed some protesters being pinned to the ground and apparently arrested. Tulane University said at least 14 protesters were arrested from an illegal encampment the school said was dominated by protesters unaffiliated with our community. At UCLA, video posted on social media showed counter-demonstrators battering a makeshift barricade around pro-Palestinian protesters. The Los Angeles Police Department said it was responding to the school's request to restore order due to multiple acts of violence within the large encampment. "The violence unfolding this evening at UCLA is absolutely abhorrent and inexcusable," Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass said in a post on X. LAPD has arrived on campus. The Jewish Federation of Los Angeles issued a statement saying it was appalled at the violence and that it did not represent the Jewish community or our values. The statement also blamed the melee on the UCLA administration for allowing an environment that made students feel unsafe. Earlier, UCLA Chancellor Jean Block said barriers demonstrators used to block access to buildings had been removed, and staff were positioned around Royce Quad to help ensure that they will not go up again. The student conduct process has been initiated and could lead to disciplinary action, including suspension or expulsion, he said. New York City police made 119 arrests at Columbia University and 173 at City College in Tuesday's crackdowns on protesters, Commissioner Edward Caban said Wednesday. Charges range from trespass to criminal mischief to burglary, and the breakdown of students to non-students facing charges was not yet available, he said. Police also said there were no injuries, although the group CUNY for Palestine issued a statement saying one student suffered a broken ankle, two had teeth broken, and others received burns from pepper spray used by police during the melee. Mayor Eric Adams said drones and encryption radios used at Columbia provided police with the element of surprise when they retook Hamilton Hall, adding that professionals at radicalizing had influenced the student protesters and co-opted the protest, but did not provide details. Officers climbed into Hamilton Hall, which protesters had occupied earlier Tuesday, through a second-story window. Within 3 hours Tuesday night, they had retaken the building, NYPD said. Columbia President Manoush Shafiq released a letter early Wednesday asking police to stay on campus until at least May 17th, 2 days after graduation, to maintain order and ensure that encampments are not reestablished. Some student activists who pitched tents and camped on university lawns to protest Israel's military attacks in Gaza have begun to declare victory after hammering out agreements with school administrators. The students want their schools to stop funneling endowment money to Israel companies and other businesses that profit from the war in Gaza, and to end academic partnerships with Israel as well. In many cases, students also seek amnesty from disciplinary actions. Northwestern University became the first U.S. school to publicly announce a deal on Monday. On Tuesday, Brown University protesters broke camp after President Christina Paxson said the Rhode Island school will bring divestment demands to a vote. Organizers hope the deal set a new precedent for protest encampments around the U.S. and show a way to find common ground without using force. What these students have done is truly, truly historical, Summer Papachan, a graduate student and organizer of the Northwestern encampment, told USA Today Tuesday. We have been able to achieve our goals while keeping our students safe. Okay, T-Rex at center of a debate over dinosaur intelligence. Surmising even the physical appearance of a dinosaur, or any extinct animal, based on its fossils is a tricky proposition with so many uncertainties involved. Assessing a dinosaur's intelligence, considering the innumerable factors contributing to that trait, is exponentially more difficult. A study published last year by Vanderbilt University neuroscientist Susanna Herculano-Huzel, that's a hyphenated name, that evaluated the intelligence of Tyrannosaurus rex, focusing upon estimated brain size and the number of brain neurons as comparable to that of primates, specifically a baboon, caused a stir in scientific circles. Now, an interdisciplinary scientific team has published a study in rebuttal, questioning Herculano-Huzel's methodology and challenging her appraisal of the smarts of T-Rex and other big dinosaur predators in the dinosaur clade called theropods. They instead suggested a more holistic approach to assess the braininess of Tyrannosaurus or any extinct animal, with brain size and neuronal count considered alongside other factors such as an animal's anatomy and ecology, data from living relatives, and fossil evidence about how it moved about and fed that offer insight into its life. Our key findings are that the brains of most dinosaurs, including T-Rex, were comparable in relative size to those of living reptiles, such as crocodiles and alligators. Furthermore, their neuron numbers were likely not exceptional, especially for animals of their body mass, said zoologist Kai Kaspar of Heinrich Heine University in Germany, who studies the behavior of living animals and was the lead author of the study published this week in the Anatomical Record Journal. What needs to be emphasized is that reptiles are certainly not as dim-witted as is commonly believed, Kaspar said. Their behaviors can be very complex, and the experimental data we have point to many cognitive similarities between them, mammals and birds. So, whereas there is no reason to assume that T-Rex had primate-like habits, it was certainly a behaviorally sophisticated animal. Herculano Huzel said she stands by her findings and called the new analysis flawed. The only thing that is under dispute is what already was at the time of my study, what was actually the size of dinosaur brains. Even then, we're talking about the difference between a T-Rex brain being baboon or monkey-sized, Herculano Huzel said. Their conclusion hinges on a single extremely important point, whether theropods like T-Rex shared their brain-to-body size relationship with their extant, warm-blooded ostrich and chicken cousins, or with their more distant living relatives, crocodiles. I said the former because I compared theropods to ostriches and chickens. They now say the latter, Herculano Huzel added. Kaspar said the comparison to modern birds also was an integral part of the new study. The dinosaurs, aside from their bird descendants, disappeared 66 million years ago after an asteroid struck Earth. After two centuries of scientific study, dinosaurs are coming into better focus, though plenty of uncertainties remain about Tyrannosaurus and the others. 3D printed organ replicas give students experience. Wearing blue rubber gloves, Molly Dubrow reached into a metal vat of diluted sodium hydroxide and pulled out two dripping wet models of human organs, a heart and a set of lungs. Made of elastico, a kind of elastomer, they had been 3D printed in a lab at the University of North Florida, then put in the sodium hydroxide bath, which ate away any unneeded material, leaving these scaled-down replicas that recreate human organs and body parts with remarkable accuracy. It's all part of a UNF undergraduate class called Anatomy in 3D, taught by Laura Habiger, an assistant professor of biology, and Grant Bevel, an associate professor of mechanical engineering. The university teamed up with Mayo Clinic to offer the class for the first time this spring semester. The course gives biology and engineering students experience in a growing medical field. Habegger said it could help students find jobs, if they choose such a path, in 3D medical printing labs. More medical professionals are using 3D printing to create duplicates of a patient's organ based on numerous CT and MRI scans. Surgeons can then, before even making the first incision, examine the organ and map out their surgical approach, Habiger said. That can make for better outcomes and reduce time in surgery. Some insurance companies are even starting to cover the cost of models, she said. Dubrow A graduate student displayed a model of a brain made in yellow elastico, inside of which was a small mass of black material that represented a brain tumor, all based on the scans of an anonymous patient. It's very common in surgical practice for surgeons to request the development of these models so they can do surgical pre-planning, said DeBrow, who has been accepted into the University of Florida's doctorate program in biomedical engineering. The surgeon can actually practice. Using some 600 slices of CT scans each, students Ansley Bates and John McGarity had created spines showing a patient with scoliosis, both before surgery, Bates' model with a sharp bend, and after, McGarity's straighter with implanted rods to support it. The students wore big grins as they saw the finished products. "You really get a better idea of anatomy from looking at this," Bates said. Yu-Yeon Young created a model of a brain with a tumor that you take out and look at from all sides. "You could hold it in your hands," she said. "It really helps to observe it from all angles." Young got a degree in biology and is now getting a master's in mechanical engineering. The UNF class was designed to attract students in both of those fields to encourage collaboration and shared expertise. Consider the project of Christian Diakos, a mechanical engineering student who wants to work in the field of prosthetics and medical devices, and Patrick Contu, who's applying to medical schools this summer. Contu said that teamwork with Diakos was essential. "He's the engineer, so he knew how to do all the computer work, and I came from the biological and anatomical aspect," he said. "The beauty of an interdisciplinary class," Diakos said. "It is so cool." Librarian spreads story of love and literacy. Says all children have right to read, sees selves in books they can access. Ask Michael Threets to share a little bit about himself, and he immediately starts talking about libraries. It's fitting, though, because libraries helped shape who the Fairfield, California man is today, a walking, fast-talking advocate for books and reading, for the people who serve the public and the places where anyone can feel welcome, safe, and valued. "I was practically raised by libraries," said Threets, a homeschooled child who spent many days, weeks, months, years in the Solano County Library, then grew up to become the library's director. "It was where my mom got our curriculum and where I read about people like me, so we knew about our culture," said Threets, whose mom is Mexican and whose father is black. He got a bachelor's degree from the University of Phoenix and studied library science at San Jose State, and then found himself back where he'd spent so many hours as a child, asking how he could apply for a job. Threets loves libraries so much, he's created a thriving social media presence based around them. He has hundreds of thousands of followers on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and X. His high-energy videos extol the virtues of libraries, the people who work in them, the people who utilize them, and the books and other resources that can be found within them. But Threets talks about weightier topics too, such as diversity and inclusiveness in books and the need for representation, and about mental health and his own struggles. Librarians are often on the front lines of culture wars over books ban, censorship, and what kind of stories, authors, and books belong in public spaces. "Many of my first book friends were either white characters or animals," Threets said. "There was not a lot of representation, but that's changed a lot. We're seeing ourselves a lot more, and it's a lot less black characters and more characters who happen to be black or Asian or Hispanic or in a wheelchair or LGBTQ. His corner of California, sandwiched between San Francisco and Sacramento, is diverse and politically liberal, so Solano County librarians don't wrestle with controversial topics too often. That, though, doesn't dampen his feelings for fellow librarians elsewhere. Parents concerned about their child's reading materials they're not ready for can talk to their children, read along with them, and have age-appropriate discussions that work for them and their family, he said. But book bans take away that freedom for all families. We always fight together, Threet said. We hear about these things happening all over, and we're all in this fight. We're all here to meet this challenge. We all believe everyone has the right to read and the right to see themselves in that book on the library shelf. Relentlessly positive, many of his videos and posts still acknowledge the challenges people face. He urges followers to ask for help, to read books to educate and illuminate, to spend time with people and in places that bring them joy or feed their souls. The need to protect his own mental health was what led him to step down recently from his role with the Solano County Library, though he's hardly idle. He's teamed up with PBS Kids and the Children's Literacy Initiative to promote education, reading, and literacy. One of Michael's strongest gifts is his empathetic storytelling, which aligns perfectly with our work at PBS, said Carolyn McLeod, PBS Kids Senior Manager for Social Media. As their new resident librarian, Threet's online presence and professional expertise line up well with PBS Kids' educational mission, which in turn creates a space for his personality to come through and give it that special spark, McLeod said. The collaboration was driven in large part because fans of both seemed to think it was a natural fit. We noticed our audience starting to tag us in Michael's content and vice versa in mid-2023, McLeod said. She messaged him, and they found a lot of common ground. The importance of literacy, mental health, and encouraging a sense of belonging and community. Libraries are meant for anyone and everyone, Threet says, a safe place where people can make human connections without spending a penny. It's a place where you can talk not just about books, but about movies and music. For some people, it's the only place where they can access a computer and connect to others online. Especially after the isolation of the pandemic, we're all suffering and struggling, and I try to help people understand that they're not alone, that other people feel the same way. He hopes it's good for the people who see him online, and he knows it's good for him. I never really know who's listening or who needs to hear a particular message on a particular day. So in some ways, it's like I'm talking as much to myself as I am to everyone else. Library people, as he calls them, helped Threet through his own difficulties with depression, social anxiety, panic attacks, and nightmares, he said. Books offer an escape, but also ways to understand other people better. They can build empathy and compassion. Michael is so consistent in his messaging about mental health and the importance of libraries, and that motivates people to action, said Priscilla Williams of the Children's Literacy Initiative, which has partnered with Threet for virtual and in-person events. He talks a lot about the joy and empathy books can build in kids. He reminds me of LeVar Burton, the actor and literacy activist. His light and his joy just shine through. All right, what's going on this weekend? Kentucky Derby, Star Wars-themed events, highlight events in Springfield. It's a duel of fates this weekend between the niche and well-loved events in town. Celebrate sports of all sorts with rat races you've never have guessed, to costume smugglers and Wookiees around town. For the second year in a row, Kentucky Burn Bar on the North End is celebrating over 100 years of sportsmanship with whiskey, bourbon, and good company. According to the bar, boatloads of drink specials will be available to celebrate the Kentucky Derby with a glass in hand. The mint julep includes a souvenir derby glass for first purchase. Games and prizes will also be available at the event for best dressed and best hat alongside comforting Southern food. This is going to happen at 2 p.m. on Saturday at the Kentucky Burn at 1104 East Sangamon Avenue, Springfield. Information about the menu and game day can be found at KentuckyBurn.com. If betting on horses isn't your fancy, why not high-velocity vermin? The Rat-Tucky Derby, a night at the Mouse's Races fundraiser, is throwing a spoof on the annual Kentucky Derby for a good cause. With actual mouse tracks set up for the inaugural races, tables will be set around the clubhouse with mouse roulette, plinko, silent auction, and a raffle. All proceeds benefit Community Child Care Connection, a nonprofit assisting parents in finding affordable child care and education. That is taking place at 6:30 p.m. on Friday at the Firefighters Lake Club at 940 West Lakeshore Drive. Tickets are $25 in advance and $30 at the door, with each ticket purchase including entry and dinner provided by Razzo's Family Pizzeria and non-alcoholic beverages. Celebrate cantina style with the Wakery this Star Wars Day by tuning into your inner sci-fi fan. Any fan of the comics, movies, games, or TV shows is welcome to the event, open to the public, to share a Star Wars-themed drink and food at this galactic event. After the public cantina closes at 6 p.m., the party does not stop there. A private ticketed Star Wars dinner with multi-course meals will be served by Emerald Eats later into the night with rounds of drinks by the Wakery. This occurs on Saturday from 2 to 11 p.m. at the Wakery at 5 West Old State Capitol Plaza in Springfield. Tickets can be purchased online on the Wakery's website for $65 per person in this limited space setting. A Revenge of the Fifth Star Wars themed Death Star painting event on Sunday will also be available from 2 to 4 p.m. for $35 per person. It takes two to duel, and with the local improv teams, it's sure to be entertaining. Capital City Improv and the Teen Improv Troupe present Jedi and Padawans, an improv play set in a galaxy far, far away. Come for the fast wit and laugh and watch a new tale from outer space fly. The improv event will host a costume contest for the crowd to dress their Star Wars best. Wookiees, Rebels, and Imperials can compete for best dressed to win a prize on Saturday night at 7 p.m. at the Club Room at the Hoagland Center for the Arts at 420 South 6th Street in Springfield. All ages are welcome, even the younglings. For this ticketed event, tickets are $15 per person and can be purchased at hcfta.org/tickets. Star Wars and horse races not up that alley? Find art and spoken word with the liturgical arts. With this year's theme of creation, revelation of the divine, crosses into faith and celebration of it as part of the biannual festival hosted by the Liturgical Arts Festival of Springfield. The week-long event, beginning Saturday, will continue throughout next week until May 11th, and each day will be centered around its own theme and exhibit to attend around the city. The festival is inspired by the beautiful diversity of faith traditions within the community, as programs are accessible to those of any faith or none. 2 to 7 p.m. Saturday, May 4th to May 11th, with each day having its own schedules. The Sunday event starts at 3 p.m. Locations differ by day. Saturday events will be held at 700 North 4th Street for the Juried Art Gallery. Information for all events can be found online at lafspringfield.org/festival. All days of the event are free. Okay, newly opened Springfield business offers great food and good atmosphere. The name of the business being reviewed is Eagle Golf and Grill, found at 3941 Pintail Drive in Springfield. Phone 217-970-4137. Website eaglegolfandgrill.com. Credit and debit cards accepted. Hours, Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Friday and Saturday, 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. and Sunday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. The entree price range is $8 to $20. There is no children's menu. The reviewer's order. This new indoor golf facility with golf simulator bays, indoor putting, chipping green, and training area offers appetizers, salads, sandwiches, and pizza. Breakfast offered subject to availability. We chose to sit in the dining area by the putting and chipping green, where it was light and quiet, but featured plenty of TV monitors to watch golf and other sports. My son ordered the chicken dippers with fries, $14, and my golf enthusiast companion and I split a Master's burger with a half-pound beef patty and pimento cheese. For those who don't follow golf, that cheese defines the iconic culinary staple of Augusta National's famous pimento cheese sandwich, popular during the Masters tournament. Likes were, the servings were generous and ample pimento cheese oozed from the burger. My son thought his chicken dippers were well seasoned, cooked perfectly, and generously sized. We all got a kick out of the golf-themed food and beverages. There were no dislikes. What would I order next time? I'd like to come for breakfast and try the breakfast pizza for $20. Clearing up misconceptions about Cinco de Mayo. Cinco de Mayo is just around the corner. As May 5th approaches, you might be wondering where the festive Mexican holiday came from and why. It's celebrated across the Americas, but still there is some confusion about what Cinco de Mayo is and what it means. Some wrongly believe it celebrates Mexican Independence Day. Others, probably your favorite beer company, thinks of it as a party holiday meant to sell beer and cheap tequila shots. It's more than that. Here's what you need to know. Cinco de Mayo commemorates a Mexican victory over French forces looking to turn Mexico into a monarchy in the Battle of Puebla on May 5, 1862. General Ignacio Zaragoza led the poorly equipped Mexican forces and according to Encyclopedia Britannica. Mexico's conflict with France started in 1861 when it declared a temporary moratorium on foreign debts. This led Europe's three empires, Spain, England, and France, to intervene and collect. The English and Spanish pulled out by 1862, but the French, with dreams of empire stoked by their emperor Napoleon III, remained to establish a monarchy and curb U.S. power in North America, according to Encyclopedia Britannica. French forces wouldn't be pushed out of Mexico entirely until 1867, but the early battle became a symbol of Mexican resistance to foreign domination, according to Encyclopedia Britannica. Cinco de Mayo is not a celebration of Mexican Independence Day, like many believe. Mexican Independence Day is on September 16th, and it commemorates the beginning of the Mexican War of Independence against Spain that started in 1810. While the holiday celebrates a Mexican military victory, it's not widely celebrated in the country. The state of Puebla has parades and speeches to mark the occasion, but it's not much noticed anywhere else. The holiday is much more popular in the United States. In the mid-20th century, it started as a way for Mexican immigrants to celebrate their heritage. But in the 80s, a series of ad campaigns by alcohol manufacturers caused the holiday to balloon in popularity among the general public. Now, less than 40 years later, beer sales on the Mexican holiday outpace sales from the Super Bowl and St. Patrick's Day, according to a 2013 Nielsen study. Okay, and some things to watch on TV. Netflix has a new series. Jeff Daniels leads this limited series based on Tom Wolfe's novel as Atlanta real estate mogul Charlie Croker, who faces sudden bankruptcy as he defends his empire from those attempting to capitalize on his fall from grace. Political and business interests collide. The title of the series is A Man in Full. The Tattooist of Auschwitz is on Peacock. It's a new series based on a novel by Heather Morris. It's a limited series. Historical drama tells the real-life story of Lael Sokolov, played by Harvey Keitel, a Jewish prisoner at Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration camp who was tasked with tattooing numbers on fellow prisoners' arms during World War II. On the Food Network tonight, Selena Gomez takes the next step in her culinary adventure as she heads out of her home kitchen and into the professional kitchens of some of Los Angeles' hottest restaurants. Gomez will be accompanied by her best friend as her cooking skills are put to the test by the best in the business, with the ultimate goal being to create a dish good enough to make each restaurant's menu. Ghosts on CBS tonight. The third season comes to a close tonight with Isaac's Wedding. CBS renewed the series for season 4. On ABC, Grey's Anatomy, Catherine pushes back on Link and Monica's treatment plan for a VIP. Law & Order Special Victims Unit, a runaway bride calls SVU for help on the day of her wedding. Meanwhile, Rollins pitches in on her day off. And Welcome to Wrexham on FX at 10 p.m. season premiere. The documentary series following the Wrexham AFC soccer team owned by Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney returns for season 3. For the first time ever, cameras will have unprecedented access on the pitch and inside the locker room while the action is unfolding in some of the biggest matches Wrexham has ever played. And Beautiful Rebel is on Netflix. Letitia Tony portrays Italian singer-songwriter Gianna Nannini in this movie based on the life of the artist. The film journeys into the life and creative mind of this unique and revolutionary artist who has made music and freedom her manifesto. Look like it's going to be a warm one today, partly sunny and warm, PM thunderstorm, high of 85. Stay cool and have a great week.